good afternoon. So, last time, we had this idea of an atomic operation. We learned that if we just have two threads doing things, then, well, you know, things are going to go wrong. And one of the ways that can go wrong is that, you know, things that we think are sort of going to happen as one operation might not. So we need to know what actually is sort of all together. And we say something's atomic if it happens all or not at all, and we don't have any in-between states. So for example, if we say stores are atomic, either we see the value before the store or the value after a store at some location in memory. We don't see some in-between value. It's not like we're writing the value bit by bit. And this prevents us from getting some results that might be otherwise non-intuitive. And we learned that, you know, we have to know what operations are atomic, and it's not necessarily that much. So we saw that, like, the add instruction on x86, if we're adding to a location in memory, yeah, it's one instruction, it's not atomic. If you have multiple cores, you can observe that that actually takes multiple steps, and you can observe some in-between results and therefore get answers that wouldn't make sense if we just did a lot of adds. And we also learned that if we want to coordinate between different threads, that atomic loads and stores, they're technically sufficient. There's a way of doing all our coordination using them, but it's really awkward and really complicated to prove anything about. So it's not what we're going to do. It's, you know, it's technically enough, but it's not going to be convenient to program, and our processors are going to provide us some additional functionality, and we'll talk about some of that today, in order to do some useful coordination between threads. And then we move to talking about some abstractions. Well, one abstraction for coordinating between threads, and this is probably the most common one and the most frequently used one, though we'll talk about some more over the next couple weeks, which was this idea of a lock. So a lock is something where we either have a lock or we don't. And if we have a lock, no one else can have it. So the lock is a way of us getting exclusive access to something, is the idea. And well, how's the exclusion formed? With the abstraction we learned, it's exclusive because I agree that when anyone tries to access some shared resource, we're going to first acquire the lock. And the acquire operation is going to wait for the lock to be available, to not be acquired by anyone else. So if someone else is using the resource, I'm going to sit there waiting for it to be free. And when that other person's done using the resource, they're supposed to do this release operation, which allows someone else to acquire the lock. And so to use this to make sure a shared resource, like say our account balance, you know, behaves as expected, we're going to alloc before using the shared resource. So we're going to make sure that we're the only one accessing it, waiting if necessary to do that, and unlock afterwards. And with the lock abstraction we learned, this is something that we're going to have to remember to do ourselves. If we forget to lock before accessing that account balance, well, we're going to have the problem we started with of that lost write, where, oops, we did a computation on a value while it was being changed, and we used the old version, not the changed version. That can just happen. And we saw two sort of concrete implementations of this abstraction. One was pthread mutexes, and one was XV6 spinlock. Which has some interfaces that implemented this with different names for things, but it's the same kind of abstraction. So questions about things we covered last time. Okay, so we looked at locks. So I'm gonna talk first a bit about a practical issue, which is, we've learned about locks. Can I use a vector for multiple threads and not have things go crazy? And And this depends on how it's implemented. So we could imagine a version of a vector where every single operation acquires a lock, does the operation, and unlocks. In that case, the answer would be yes. Like if you have two threads pushing back on a vector, things will work fine. If you have two threads reading from a vector, like you'll get consistent results. Every operation in the vector will appear atomic. So that would be a reasonable implementation of a vector. And if you want to know that, well, it depends, you know, it's implemented. And if we think about maybe it doesn't do locking, are things actually unsafe? Well, let's say the vector just, you know, said our vectors are going to be 1,000 elements, and we allocated 1,000 elements and didn't support any larger size. In that case, well, pushback, or rather setting elements, would be safe because the array isn't being reallocated. But we know that probably it's a dynamically allocated array with size changes, right? And if we think about, let's say I'm reading from the vector while it's being reallocated, I could read from the old version or the new version. And exactly when that's unsafe would depend on exactly when the vector resizes things. But you might say, okay, so if it's a dynamically allocated array, that means I can't really rely on things, you know, when I'm changing the size of the vector, but maybe when I'm not doing that, it's safe. But do we really know that? Let's say I write a vector where I say, oh, after I do a lot of accesses, if the vector is very large, let's shrink it on a read. That's not unreasonable, but that would break our assumption that, oh, I can have multiple threads read from the same vector, as long as it's not changing size. And in general, we don't want to have to reason about what are the internals of the vector in order to use it for multiple threads. We'd really like to be able to use things like vectors and other data structure libraries we have lying around for multiple threads without having to ask these sorts of questions about what is it doing internally? Is it resizing an array? When does it resize the array? Is it going to do it on like a, you know, a pop operation? Is it going to do it on a get operation, an add operation? And the people who made the C++ standard thought about this problem, and what they did is they didn't specify vectors are implemented in a particular way. They instead specified some generic rules for how containers, meaning all the sort of data structures in the C++ standard library, work. And they said, hey, if no one's changing anything, multiple threads can read anything at the same time. So if the vector is not changing, you can have as many threads as you want reading. So this means the vector, if it's going to do something like resize the array to be smaller when you read from it to save space, it can't. That's not allowed unless it does locking. So the implementation needs to make it work for multiple threads, meaning they need to do locking or something like that if they're doing that sort of resizing. They also have the second rule that you can only read an element if no other thread is modifying it. It doesn't mean it won't work to read an element that's being modified. That means that the people who wrote the C++ standard said, we have no guarantees on what will happen. Maybe it will just work out fine. Maybe, like, we'll have a pointer that will be dangling when you try to do that. Like, if you think of, like, a binary tree, maybe the binary tree will change as the element's being written, and you'll access like a pointer that's now deallocated, and your program will crash. So if you follow these rules, you can read from it, and also have this rule that if no other threads are accessing it, you can add or remove elements, and some containers have some extra rules that let you add it or remove elements without having to worry about this. But you have to look them up. And this idea that the people who wrote the C++ standard library like specify what's allowed is a general pattern we see in libraries. If you want to know, how do I use this library for multiple threads? Well, they better tell you. Because if they don't, you're just making guesses about what their implementation is like, and it really needs to be part of the interface. The interface needs to not only say, like, this is how you get a value and how you set a value, it also needs to say, this is when you can safely do this for multiple threads. And I have one exception here that I'd like to mention because it might come up in some future assignments and also in the real world, which is that you think, okay, so vectors, you can, you know, read any element that's not being written. Vectors of bools are an exception to this in C++. And the reason why is the people who designed the C++ standard library wanted to make it possible to implement vectors of bools by putting multiple booleans together in one int. And that means that when you write to a single boolean, it's going to update an integer that contains multiple booleans. So if you have two of those happening at the same time, weird things could happen. And they said, well, we don't care enough about making this work multiple threads. We're just going to say, don't do that. If you want to have a vector of booleans, you can't access it safely for multiple threads at the same time. Or write two different elements for multiple threads at the same time. Sorry. So questions on sort of library rules for how you use them with threads. Yes? Why is this directly relevant? So one thing is we're going to have an assignment where you're probably going to want to use C++ containers. The other is we just talked about locks. And a big thing that comes up, practically speaking, is using locks to control access to a shared resource where you don't actually know how the resource is implemented, like vectors or maps. And this is the experience you're going to have. You're going to have to hope to have documentation if you want to access it simultaneously for multiple threads. Otherwise, you really can't make any assumptions. Because you will be surprised by things like, oh, they're storing multiple booleans in one int, getting you into trouble. Does that answer your question? When I say accessing container, I mean reading or writing. And including things like asking for its size, anything that would do access it, yes. Is there any downside to using locks all the time? It's slower. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So I guess the reason for the boolean is because of silly implementation emails, right? So some of them might be able to.
So question, the reason for the boolean is because of specific implementation details? Yes. And the people who basically the C++ standard committee is a bunch of people, mostly who are compiler writers, got together and said, hey, we want to implement vectors of bools this way, therefore we're not going to guarantee as much for them. I think most of them these days regard this as a mistake, but it's a decision they made, and therefore it's something you have to deal with when you're using a C++ standard library. Other questions? Yes. So question, how is the container implemented? So I have rules for containers because the C++ standard library has vectors, it has lists, it has queues, it has maps, it has sets, it has all sorts of data structures. These rules are for all of them. So they agreed that we're going to implement all of these different types of data structures in this way, and this is the rules for using our implementations of them. And tells you about when you need to do locking when you're using them. Yes?
So how are you applying this to life homework?
So if you want to write to something from the life homework, that tells you when you can do it without while reading from it, like a vector. So question, do you check the conditions before doing it? So generally, the way you're going to apply with rules like this is you're going to structure your code to make sure that if like one thread's writing to something, another thread is not also accessing that value, for example. And you're going to use locks and other synchronization constructs we learned about to guarantee that if it's not done for free. So for example, if thread 1 always writes to index 0 and thread 2 always writes to index 2, well, they're not going to write to the same thing. but sometimes it might not be so simple. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about locks, and we talked about sort of ways you'd use libraries by adding locks to comply with their requirements that you don't do two things at the same time from different threads. So locks seem like most of what we need to make two threads work well together. Are there cases where we need more? Well, I'm asking the question, so probably yes. And we've in fact seen some. We've seen some things that we really can't implement with locks that are functionality we want. So for example, we've seen pipes. So pipes let us write and have something read. And that read operation is supposed to wait until a write happens. We learn that that's how it works. If that data is not available, the read waits for some data to be available. Implementing that waiting operation is really awkward with locks. The only way we can really do it is what I'll call busy waiting, where we're gonna like unlock, check if there's data, locking to do that, because we need to worry about, you know, not accessing two things at the same time. Check if there's data, unlock, check again. We could just do that in a loop, but that's really inefficient. We're just hogging a processor, checking for another thread changing something. We really want some way of the other thread starting us when that data is available. So we're going to want a different type of synchronization primitive for that. Oh, I thought I had more example. I guess I moved the slides. So another example, too, is pthread join. So pthread join waits for a thread to finish. We don't have a way of waiting for something to finish. Right? Locks can't really do that. Right? They acquire a resource, they don't wait for someone to finish. So we're going to need some other primitives to do that. And we're just generally going to need ways to wait for threads to finish for things. We don't have that kind of operation. We have a get exclusive access to something. We don't have a wait for something else to happen. And there's several strategies for implementing that. And so we're later on going to talk about a bunch of synchronization ideas beyond locks. And I'm going to start with one today called barriers, which I'm mentioning today partly because it's in the life assignment. So I want to cover it today and not after the life assignment's out. And partly because it's probably the simplest of these. We're also going to talk about some much more flexible mechanisms, which can do all sorts of weird synchronization tasks. If you have some way you want to coordinate two threads, you can probably do it with monitors and condition variables. And you can probably do it with counting semaphores. Like each of these alone would be sufficient to do pretty much anything you want to do that involves having two threads coordinate with each other. You know, waiting for things to be true and so on, you can do that with these. And we'll also talk about a sort of special case of locks, or a sort of extension of locks that's more specialized, but it comes up a lot, called the reader-writer locks. So first, on barriers. So when I talked about introducing threads, I had this idea, okay, so let's say we're summing up an array, and I want to sum up the array with multiple threads, so I'll sum up the first half of the array with one thread, the second half with another thread. Or we can say the same thing here, I'm saying we're doing the minimum. Same operation, right? We compute the minimum of the first half, minimum of the second half, then we compute the minimum of the minimums. And the barrier is going to be something that's kind of specialized for doing this sort of wait for everything to finish operation. So a barrier is going to be this sort of object in sort of the object-oriented sense, which has two operations. It's built around this waiting. So it has an initialize operation where we specify how many threads there are that are going to be involved in the wait operation. And we have this wait operation, which is going to be called by every single thread. So every single thread is going to sync up by calling this wait operation. And when all of them have called wait, then the wait operation returns. And this is specialized for this extremely common pattern where we perform a bunch of parts of a calculation in parallel, and we want to wait for everyone to perform their part before we go on to the next part. So if we're thinking about our parallel min operation, sort of what I might do is I initialize my barrier for two threads. Thread 0 gets the min of the first half of the elements. Thread 1 gets the min of the second half, and they both call wait. Once two things have called wait, wait can return. But before that, so right after thread 0 calls wait, wait has to not return because only one thing is called wait, not two. Once two things have called wait, thread 0 can move on. Also, thread 1 can move on, but it doesn't have anything to do. And it can complete this operation. So this is kind of serving the same purpose as pthread join served for us previously, but we don't have to have the thread terminate. We just have to have the thread meet a particular wait point. And we're also, you know, we don't have to just have one thread wait for another. We can have all the threads wait for each other. So we have this sort of mutual operation, and we'll see an example on the next slide of why that's useful. So questions on what's going on in this example? Yes?
So for thread 0 is going to wait for thread 1 to call wait?
So the question is, thread 0 is going to wait for thread 1 to call wait? Yes. And thread 1 is going to wait for thread 0 to call wait, if it called it before thread 1, thread 0 did. The question, which one waits for what? They both wait for each other, depending on who's first. And if we had a third thread, so if we had a thread 3, or thread 2, and we change this to 3, then this would wait for the other two threads. Thread 0 would wait for the other two threads. Everyone would wait for all the other threads. So the wait operation doesn't complete for anyone until every thread has called it. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Yeah, does thread 0 have to create thread 1?
The question is, thread 0 have to create thread 1? There is no such requirement. So another advantage, the threads can be completely unrelated as long as they all have access to the same barrier and we set the count correctly when we initialize it. Yes? Question, the moment all the threads hit barrier wait, all of them at that exact instant will move on to the next step. So all of them will be able to run at that point. When they get run depends on how our scheduler works. Yes? Yeah?
Is it possible to have like multiple barriers doing similar things at the same time, like the way you can do with maybe like fork and wait PID?
So question is, can I have multiple barriers? Absolutely. And it would make sense if you like had, were doing multiple calculations at the same time to do that. Yeah. Just like we can have multiple locks. Other questions? Yeah. Question, by setting parallel min equal to barrier to weight, that is not what this is doing. Parallel min is equal to this thing that's commented out. But presumably would be some for loop. Yes?
How is this different from using thread join?
How is this different from using thread join? So both thread 0 and thread 1 can continue doing stuff afterwards, or thread 2 with this additional jump. And we'll see that being useful on the next slide. Yes?
How would you use this in conjunction with spin locks?
You mostly would not. Questions, one or the other you never use together? You would probably use them for different parts of your task. So the barrier assumption is sort of that everyone is that you've divided up your problem in some way where there's distinct steps. And spin locks and locks in general usually don't assume that sort of organization. Yes? Is total min in thread 0? So in this example, total min is being computed in thread 0, which is just an arbitrary choice I made. I could have put that code in any thread I wanted, as long as it waited for this barrier. Yes? Question, which thread finishes first depends on which one wait first. So it doesn't matter what order the calls to wait happen in as far as whether this total min, so this total min operation is guaranteed to happen after the two partial min operations. Whether that happens because thread 0 calls wait first and waits for thread 1, or because thread 1 called wait before thread 0 did, we don't know and we don't really care. That answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Yes?
The wait in thread 1 only wait until the thread 0 calls the wait?
Question is, the wait in thread 1 only wait until thread 0 calls the wait? When we have a barrier size of 2, yes. It waits for the number of threads we initialized it with to call wait. And if your thread 0 is called wait, that's one count for that number of threads. So we just need to make sure there's one more. If we initialize it with 2, if we initialize it with 3, we need to wait for 2 more. Yes?
And when do we initialize the barrier?
When do we initialize the barrier? Sometime early on in our program. Yes?
Do you initialize the barrier in one of the threads?
Can I initialize the barrier in one of the threads? Yes, as long as you somehow get it to the other threads after it's initialized. Yeah?
So, possibly have 100 threads and just do barrier.initialize one, where just wait for the first one?
So it's possible to have 100 threads and do barrier.initialize one and have it only wait for one? Yes, but I strongly recommend against it because I cannot think of a case where that is useful. Yes?
You can initialize barrier twice, like barrier initialize one and two. Are they waiting for...
This question, if I call initialize the barrier twice, what happens? You shouldn't, you're not allowed to do that. If you want to have barriers with different numbers of threads, create a new one. Okay, so I've shown sort of the simple use case for barriers. So what makes barriers interesting versus like join is that barriers are reusable. So once when they wait once, we can wait again with them. And this gives sort of the more canonical use case. So here I have a, let's say a simulation here where thread 0 computes element 0 of our results. And we have, we have results. You know, time part. So our result at time 0 is computed by thread 0. Our result at time 0 and part 0 is computed by thread 0. Result at time 0 and part 1 is computed by thread 1. And then our result for time 1, part 0, is computed by thread 0 from both parts of the result from time 0. So this is a typical pattern we have in a simulation of something physical, like, say, weather. Where, well, we want to use what happened in the past to compute the future, but what was computed for the past is going to be computed for multiple different threads. So for this sort of pattern, barriers are great. We have this barrier.wait operation, which in each case is going to wait for, in this case, if the barrier has two threads, for the other thread to have called wait, before we move on to the next step, which needs the results from the prior iteration. And it's reusable, so we can call barrier.wait again to wait for a second call to wait from all the threads. And this is sort of the typical pattern barriers are designed for and what makes them really so much more useful than, say, than joining a thread. Yes?
So if results of 1, 1, you use results of 1, 0 in the computation, then you would put the barrier.wait at the beginning of the results of 1.
So question, if I wanted for results of 1, 1 to use results of 1, 0, I would need to, yes, to have this barrier here. But that's not a design that's very common. What if I call wait an additional time in thread 1?
Three times in thread 1.
If I call it wait 3 times in thread 1, then the third call to wait won't complete unless another thread also calls wait.
So it will forever wait there.
So question, so if I have an extra call to wait in one thread, then it's that call is never going to return unless an appropriate number of other threads also call wait that additional time. Each call to wait waits for needs enough threads to also call wait in tandem. Yes. Can I have different numbers of wait statements within each thread? Yes, but one of them will wait indefinitely. So it's probably a mistake. Other questions? Yeah.
How does the class barrier implemented?
How is barrier implemented? We will, so we're not gonna go into that, but when we talk about these two monitors and semaphores, it will be possible to use both of either of these to implement barriers, and that is one possible implementation. There's a few other ways they could be implemented too. Does that answer your question? So that's what barriers are. Other questions on? Yes. So in this example, it's either initialized to two or we have some threads I'm not showing. Okay, so pthreads has barriers. So there's a barrier type, there's a barrier init operation, which takes the number of threads, it also takes an attributes field, which will usually leave as null, and it has a wait operation. And as I mentioned, one of the reasons I'm going over this now is because we have the life homework. And in the life homework, we have a simulation where we do, this is sort of roughly what the given code does, which is single threaded. And it computes a new value based on the old values in the grid, in a grid. So we have a grid of values, it computes new values in a grid based on old values in a grid. And then it does a swap operation to make the new grid become the old grid and goes on to the next step. And we do this for some number of iterations. And your task in the life assignment is to split up this computation so we can do multiple of these computations in parallel from different threads. And you need to make this work, we need to make sure that we don't use values in from grid until they're actually set. And my recommendation would be to use barriers to do that. Yes?
Are there any other structures that we use for that assignment besides the barrier?
What are other structures you use for the assignment? So this grid is implemented with a vector.
Synchronization structures?
Barriers are sufficient to implement the assignment, but you are welcome to use additional structures if you think they were helpful. You don't need to use locks, yes. You do not need to use locks, barriers are enough. But if you want to use locks, I'm not going to stop you. Yes? Is there a difference between pthread barrier versus the regular barrier? So this barriers that we're showing you here, this is sort of the abstract view. Like I showed you locks, sort of abstractly what they are. That's what I was showing you here. So pthread barrier is one implementation of that abstraction. Yes? If they were using a vector of Booleans, then you'd have to use locks. For this reason, if you look, the life code we supply you implements the grid with a vector of unsigned pairs, even though the values are effectively Booleans. Yes?
Can you go over the attributes specific?
Can I go over the attributes?
Yeah.
I leave them as null. So this is where we could set, like if there were multiple types of barriers, this is where we'd set that information. I don't know actually whether there are, and we don't really care. But if like the POSIX library wanted to support like barriers with error checking versus fast barriers, this is where you'd set that sort of setting. Yes. So this pthread barrier wait is how POSIX is the POSIX interface that's equivalent to what I showed as abstractly as barrier.wait, yes. Other Questions? Yeah.
Is barrier in the life homework only necessary because of multi-threading?
Question is, barrier in the life homework only necessary because of multi-threading? So you need something, well, barriers wouldn't do anything with a single thread, right? We think of barrier.wait, it waits for the number of threads that we specify to finish. If we have one thread, that number is one, and one thread called wait, so it wouldn't do anything. Yes?
So just to clarify, the skeleton of life works, it's just that we want to reduce the speed.
Question, the skeleton of life works, it's just that we want to reduce the speed? Yes, so the skeleton of life works, but it only uses a single thread, so it has no ways of taking advantage of multiple cores. Yes? So question is about single-threaded optimizations. So for the life assignment, you are allowed to do single-threaded optimizations, but they are not neither necessary, nor will they help your grade. We care about the difference in performance between the single-threaded version of your code and your code using multiple threads. Yes? The question is, there a certain speedup we're looking for? There are certain speedups we expect. The biggest thing we expect, which is specified in the assignment, is that if we have a large enough grid, we expect the speedup to be approximately proportional to the number of threads, provided we have sufficiently many cores to run each thread in the separate core. We don't care so much if your performance degrades when the grid's very small, which is likely to happen because barrier weight takes some time to coordinate between the threads. Okay, and another note on the barrier operation, sorry, the life assignment. For COA 2, there is an additional requirement. So if you've taken the pilot version of computer organization and architecture, which has been renamed since, you would know if you were in that pilot program, then you have an additional requirement because this assignment should be very familiar to you. Also, you have an additional requirement on the next assignment. And I guess for reference to people who aren't in there, by very familiar, I mean people in the pilot COA program did essentially exactly this assignment. That's why they have extra work to do on this and the next assignment. Because they should be able to use their old code. If you don't have it, I can get a copy probably and adapt it for our version of the assignment. So questions on that? Yes? Sorry? How big is the homework? So this is a 1 week, how big is it, how much weight does this homework have? So life and pool are 1 week assignments. So they're roughly, you can see the exact weights in the view grid computation in Kytos, but 1 week homeworks are weighted about half of 2 week homeworks. Sorry? How does it compare with the lottery and difficulty? So it's weighted the same in the grade. In difficulty, this varies tremendously. So I can't give you direct answers. There are some students who have trouble with very different things in this class. It's just the way things are. Yeah.
So if we've just taken comp work but not COA 2, then we don't have to do the additional.
Yes, so if you've just taken comp work, that's not COA 2. If you've taken COA 2, the life assignment should look very familiar to you, and that's why we're having you do extra work on it in the following assignment. Yes? Sorry? Is this related to the assignment that used vectors in computer architecture? So this is an optimization assignment, but we're not caring about single-threaded optimizations like we did in computer architecture. Okay. So that's on the life homework. So we've had a little diversion into barriers. I'm going to talk about next about implementing locks. And I'll mention that there are ways of implementing barriers and other things like join and so on that are going to use the same techniques we're going to see in implementing locks. We're going to start with implementing locks because they're probably the simplest and most common thing and most generally useful, I would say. I'm going to start by talking about implementing locks with a single core. So the simplest case, we'll worry about multi-core later. It is going to be a problem. And on the single core, all we need to worry about is context switches. If we don't have a context switch, there's no problem with the lock. So the simplest way to implement locks in a single core is to make sure context switches can't happen. And context switches happen because an exception makes the OS decide to do a context switch. And the ones that we'd be worried about happening by accident are things like a timer interrupt or a key press. So what we want to do is just disable them. And the processor has a mechanism for doing that. It has a mechanism to temporarily turn off exceptions and don't deliver them to the OS until later. So if we press a key and exceptions are disabled, the processor will not handle that key press until after exceptions are re-enabled. It will still handle it, but it will delay it until the operating system re-enables exceptions. And there are two instructions for this. Clear instruction, CLI and STI are what they're called in x86, disable interrupts, and enable interrupts, where interrupts are externally triggered exceptions. So here's our naive lock implementation based on that for single core only. So multi-core, this won't work. For single core, it will. And this implements the requirements of the lock abstraction, but it has a few practical problems. Can someone think of one? So why would I not give this lock implementation to an ordinary user? Yeah. So one question is sometimes context switches don't have an interrupt. Yes. So if the user runs a function to like wait for another program, what do we do? Like we need something else to handle that case. Okay. Yeah.
You could potentially starve all the other programs.
Yeah, we could starve all the other programs. So if I acquire a lock and have an infinite loop, that's going to hang the whole system. Because no key presses will be handled. Okay, control C won't work. No matter what. And yeah, and I can't do operations which would normally, you know, so another thing is I can't do operations which require waiting for external exceptions like, you know, reading from a disk, where the OS would normally wait for the disk to trigger, say, that is ready. Okay. So these things, we're going to have a different mechanism to handle locks that we trust users with. There's another problem, which is a little more solvable, which is with nested locks. That if I have locks for multiple things, then I can't use this implementation of unlock because I would enable interrupts too early and I wouldn't actually have my locks working like they're supposed to. Because the promise of a lock is when I, you know, unlock a lock that lets people waiting on that lock start, here they can start too early. And in this example, it's probably not a problem, but if we had anything happening here, you know, that would be a problem. That code there could execute at the same time as the other code. And it also would be a problem in this example because it turns out this unlock operation would also unlock the lock for someone else. Perfect. So to handle this nested lock issue, I have a solution for that, but we're going to have to do something more for these problems. And the observation is that these problems are problems that happen when normal programs try to use locks. But these aren't actually problems for locks being used internally in the kernel. So in the kernel, we can avoid these problems by just saying, we're writing the code. We're not going to write code which hangs the system. We're not going to write code which does I/O while holding a lock. Or at least not this type of lock. But we're often going to actually want to write code which does nested locks, but we can solve that problem. And this is part of how XV6's spin lock works. So XV6's spin lock uses, on a single core, this disable interrupts and re-enable interrupts idea. But it does it in a way which handles nested locks. So the wrapper that XV6 has for this is push CLI and pop CLI. And then there's some other code to handle multi-core. So the single core code here for push CLI. It disables interrupts if they aren't disabled already. And pop CLI pops a stack and says, if the corresponding push disabled interrupts, re-enable them. So basically, we just keep track of a counter for how many pushes did we have and versus how many pops. When that counter gets to zero, we re-enable interrupts, and we enable it as we disable them when we increase the counter. So this is just to handle nested locks to make sure we only disable, so re-enable interrupts when all the locks we currently have are released. Questions about this idea? Yes?
What is CLI?
What is CLI? CLI is the name of the instruction for disabling interrupts, which stands for clear interrupt flag. Other questions? Yeah.
So if you disable interrupts and then you do a while true, this fixes that problem.
Question, if you disable interrupts and then you do while true, this fixes that problem? It does not fix that problem. The way we're fixing this, the way we're dealing with this problem is that this is only used in the kernel, and we trust ourselves to write kernel code that doesn't do these things. So for letting user programs use locks, we're going to have to use something different, and we'll talk about that later. Talk about what the locks we give to users will look like. They will be different because we don't trust users to not do these things. Yes? What is the problem this push pop CLI fixes? This nested problem, we can have two locks at the same time without having things be broken. Other questions? Okay, so I talked about how we do locks on a single core, assuming we don't care about letting people who write code that might hang or do I/O. And this is actually enough for pretty most of the things we want to do in the kernel, but it doesn't handle the multi-core case. So how do we deal with multi-core? And to deal with that, I'm going to have a little diversion into how things work on multi-core. So earlier we talked about, we can implement locks technically with just atomic loads and stores. And there's some caveats about that when we're talking about making that work in C code we're writing. So here, for example, is me attempting to use atomic loads and stores to implement the algorithm I said worked yesterday, or Tuesday rather. And here's what the compiler did with it. I have my infinite loop while note from Bob is true. So that was like our pseudocode was while there's note from Bob, keep waiting. And this is what my compiler did with it. It decided, okay, so I'm going to load note from Bob into a register, and then I'm just going to check if that register value changes, which will never happen. So my compiler optimized this code assuming no one else is writing note from Bob. There's no other threads running, and compilers are allowed to do that. They will optimize code assuming, unless there's something to say otherwise, that no other threads are involved. And this manifests in other ways. So here, for example, I decided, okay, I'm going to have my note from Alice have two values, one for waiting, two for done. And what does the compiler do? It says, oh, you're writing one and then two? I can just write two. Let's save some instructions. Why would I bother writing one? No one can see that. So it just writes two. Doesn't write one. So we're going to need to do something to make sure the compiler doesn't do this. So we're going to have to tell the compiler, hey, this is some special code that deals with other threads. Please do not do optimizations like this. So that's one thing we're going to need to do. And also, we need to worry about the processor in some way. So earlier, I told you that loads and stores were atomic. But there's some other things about how they work where they're atomic, but that's not actually enough. We need some stronger guarantee than that. And as an example, I have some assembly code here. So I've gotten rid of compiler issues. And I have code here where in thread A, I write 1 to a global variable x and return y. And thread B, I write 1 to a global variable y and return x. And if we think about what happens when we run these at the same time, which is what the code I have here, I run these at the same time with x and y initially 0, and I print the results. And what we expect is either we do this, the first part of A, the first part of B, and then the second part of A and B, and we get two ones. Either we do A and then B, and we get 0 and 1, or we do B and then A and get 1 and 0. So those seem like the only possibilities when we do our exercises on what are the possible results, you know, when we had these different threads doing things. Right? Questions about why these seem like the possibilities based on what our two threads are doing with atomic loads and stores? Yes? Question, wouldn't they have two different stacks?
Yeah.
Yes, but these are accesses to global variables. So the code here doesn't access any of the stacks, except for the return, which doesn't affect the answer. Okay, other questions? Yeah. So does doing this limit the number of possibilities? So it seems like because, you know, A has to do read and then write, sorry, write and then read, and B has to write and then read, that these are the possibilities, right? If those reads and writes happen like they look like they should. Okay, yes? Question, does thread B have to wait for thread A? No, so pthread join, so the main thread is gonna wait for the both threads to finish, but they're gonna all execute whenever they want. So if we like think of how this works, we're gonna start a thread A and B, and they can execute in any order with each other. And then our main thread is gonna wait for both of them. And that join operation, like wait PID, you know, we could call it after the threads have already finished, or we could call it while the threads are finishing, we don't know. Does that answer your question? Yes. How do I get 0, 1? So this is if I run thread A, so I set x to 1 and return y, which is 0 because that's its initial value. And then thread B sets y to 1, which no one's going to care about, and then reads x, which was just set to 1. Other questions? Okay, so you have these possibilities based on how we reasoned about things previously. And I ran this on my system 100 million times. And here's the results I get with their frequency. And 394 times out of the 100 million, I got two zeros. And you might say, my hardware must be broken, or these loads and stores aren't atomic. But they are atomic. We either got 0 or 1. We didn't get any in-between values. What was happening here is that just like our compiler decided to like move loads and stores around to optimize things, our processor does that too. Our processor can decide to do this load before this store when it's executing things. And that's really annoying. But it's faster, so the processor does it. So if you care about coordinating between threads, we don't want this to happen. So how do we deal with it? Well, the pthreads functions do it for you. So this is a reason to use like pthread mutex lock and barrier. They handle this. They tell the compiler not to do any funky optimizations, and they tell the processor, please don't do this. And how do they do it? Well, telling the compiler not to do it is just telling the compiler, hey, this function does things with other variables. For telling the processor, there's a special instruction. So for example, on modern x86 systems, there's an instruction called mfence, which tells the processor, please do not move loads and stores across this instruction. Do all the loads that happened before this instruction before it, and do all the stores that happen, loads that happen after it. Don't move them around. And you might say, why don't we just do this all the time? Well, the way modern processors work, it's fairly expensive. So on the Intel Skylake microarchitecture, for example, this instruction takes around 33 cycles to execute. It's not something you want to be doing all the time. Yes?
So if it's so much faster, why doesn't it always do that?
What?
If it's so much faster, should you just use RET at the end for it to just like return before doing anything, like to optimize it that fast?
So question, if it's faster to optimize it. So the optimizations, it's faster to be able to move these doors around, right? But that doesn't always mean we get this answer. Right, so for us to get this 0-0 answer, not only did this read need to happen before this write, which is only faster, you know, depending on what's in the cache and so on, but also we needed to have something from thread B happen exactly in between these two instructions, which doesn't happen very often. Okay, other, yes?
Yeah, so the optimizations we're talking about here equivalent to like the pipelining that we learned about?
Are the optimizations we're talking about equivalent to the pipelining? These are optimizations related to usually out of order execution. Does that answer your question?
Okay, so it's not necessarily pipelining.
It's not necessarily pipelining? So it's usually not pipelining because in a pipeline processor, we usually execute the loads and stores in the program order. But an out-of-order processor, we have reason not to do that. And that's usually what these are a result of. Okay, other questions? Okay. Okay, so one thing this brings up is if we have a multi-core system, how do the cores coordinate with each other? And I'm going to have a very, very simplified model of that, which is not the only way things can work, but it's one way they can work, and it's going to help us explain how things happen. So one mechanism is we can have all our cores and our memory on a shared bus, meaning that they have this one communication mechanism, and they just say, hey, send messages to anyone else, and they just filter out messages that aren't for them. And there's some hardware mechanism to make sure that this works, even though like core 1 and core 2 both want to ask memory for some value. But basically what will happen is like CPU one will say, send some message, which is memory 1, what's 0x15? And memory 1 will reply, CPU 1, 0x15 is this. And we'll use the shared communication line to do that, and we'll have some mechanism to make sure that we take turns using this. So this, I said, is one way we could implement things. It doesn't really work if we have tons of cores, but that's a topic for a different class. But this is a useful way of thinking about, you know, how cores are going to coordinate. And one issue we need to be concerned about is how this works with caches. So memory is slow, so we want the cores to have copies of the values locally. So that means what's going to happen is each core is going to have a cache with some of the values, and other values are going to be in memory. And a problem these processors need to solve is that if one core writes to one of the values in their cache, we need to make sure the other cores update their corresponding cache value at some point. We don't want it to be the case that we have two different versions of the same value. That's going to be very hard to reason about and probably give us incorrect answers from our program. And we also need to figure out, have some policy about when do we change the value in memory, how do we change the value in here. So there's a bunch of different ways of implementing this. I'm not going to like go into great detail about it. That's a topic for an advanced architecture course. But using this shared bus gives sort of two high-level algorithms. So one thing is when we're modifying this value, we can send a message on this bus saying, everyone, you know, get rid of cached values of 0xA300. And doing something like that is a very common way of implementing this write here, that we need to make sure the other CPU doesn't keep that value around that's out of date now. And another part of it is what happens when, you know, let's say we get rid of this value, what happens when we want to use that value again? Well, what we can do is we can use the shared bus to announce, say, everyone, I'm going to use 0xA300, make sure I get the best version, I get the right value. So we can announce to everyone, I want this value, give it to me if you have the latest version, and so I get the right version of it. Yes? Question, when the CPU says to get rid of a value. So in the policy I'm proposing here, when we update the value, we don't actually tell them what the new value is. We just say, stop caching it, please. It's mine now. So we could also have them update the value, but that turns out to be slower because we have to send more information over the bus. And also it turns out that it's slower because typically CPU 2 is not going to use the value soon if we're modifying it. Other, yes?
But there's a difference if you use the same virtual to physical memory.
So the question is, how does this interact with virtual to physical memory translation? So all these addresses would be physical addresses. This is all stuff after address translation. Yes? Question, what do I mean by contention between multiple communicators? So something that some people think of with this scheme is CPU 1 and CPU 2 might want to do writes to at the same time. The bus has to deal with that somehow. And we're not going to talk about the mechanism for that, but if both CPU 1 and CPU 2 want to send a message on the bus, there's some way of deciding who goes first. Okay, other questions? Okay. So this problem is known as cache coherency. We have to keep the caches, you know, coherent with each other, and they have to make sense. And there's some visible consequences of cache coherency. And one of this has to do with the fact that it works with cache blocks. So typically, when we're accessing a value memory, we're accessing like 4 or 8 bytes. A typical cache block is something like 64 bytes. But the cache block, that's the thing we're saying, get rid of your copy of this, it's mine now. We're not saying get rid of these 4 bytes, we're saying get rid of these 64 bytes. And so this means that when we do a write, the processor sort of gets exclusive access to 64 bytes to update its cache. It gets rid of everyone else's copy of that 64 bytes, or whatever the size of a cache block is. And this has noticeable performance effects. So for example, here I have some code where I have an array and I access values at a, you know, in the array from at a particular location over and over again. And I have some code where I do that from 2 different threads, either at, you know, the same location or some arbitrary distance, where the distance is a number of array elements. And I time how long it takes to write the value over, to read the value, sorry, over and over again, and sort of update the value over and over again. So we're doing writes. So this ends up doing array of x, you know, plus equals array of x plus something. So I'm accessing some array place over and over, and I'm doing that at index 0 and index distance from 2 different threads. And the performance looks like this. We have, when those 2 different values that the 2 different threads are accessing are in the same cache block, it's a bunch slower. I should use red, probably. than when they're not. And that's because in order to coordinate the values in the caches, one of the cores is saying, hey, I'm accessing this part of the array. Get rid of your cache copy of it over and over again when we're in the same array cache block, the same part of the array, and when we're not, there's no contention there. There's no set. They're trying to get rid of it, but it doesn't matter because the other core isn't using that part of the array, that not that cache block. Yes? So why do they have their own copies? Because when we're writing, we have to have one person, so if we didn't have an exclusive copy for writing, we'd have to update everyone's written copies. And either way, it's going to be slower, right? We have to do extra writes if we're updating everyone else's copy.
But what if all of them just pointed to the same copy?
What if all of them just pointed to the same copy? Then we wouldn't have it cached locally, and accessing it would be slow. So this issue where accessing two different things, writing to two things that are not the same thing but are close to each other can cause us to have bad performance is called false sharing. So we're accessing two independent things that are part of the same cache block and they're slow. That means that, you know, we want to separate them. That's our fix. This problem is called false sharing. And this is a side effect of how the processors coordinate. Some questions about false sharing. So, yes. Can I give an example? So this code here, when I'm accessing two array elements that are close to each other, when this distance is small, they're in the same cache block, it's slow. If this distance is large, it's fast. Yes?
What do you mean by the solution separated by an iterator distance?
Separate them so they're in different cache blocks. Yes? Yes?
So the process of calling the cache block of that data, does it immediately fetch that data again, or does it wait until it
needs to? So question, when a process is called, a cache block is allocated, when does it fetch the data? So when you load or store, that accesses your cache, and then we need to have that cache block available. When you aren't doing a load or store to that value, it doesn't matter. Does that answer your question? Okay, so knowing how caches work, this was a little diversion from talking about how we implement locks, but this is gonna tell us how processors can provide us a way to coordinate between multiple cores. So we know that when we're modifying a value, the way it works is that the processor ensures no one else has that value cached. And they're the only one who's using it. And this allows processors to give us atomic operations that we call atomic read, modify, write operations. We can have an operation where rather than just writing to a cache value, we make sure we're the only ones with the value cached, and then we do something that's more complicated than just writing. We do something that reads the value and modifies it based on what we read and writes it back. And as an example of this, on x86, there's an instruction called atomic exchange. This is a read, modify, write value instruction. So it reads a value from memory and also writes a new value there based on from the register EAX at the same time as the read. So this is all atomic, meaning that no processor is allowed to do something with the memory location in between this read and this write. And the way we implement that is that we just tell every processor, don't cache this value anymore, please. So I'm the only one who has it, then I can do this modification. Okay, questions? This operation? So read, modify, write operations like this. I'm showing you one example. There's a whole lot of them that processors provide. This is just a simple one. This is the sort of thing we're going to use to handle locks on multiple cores. So I'm going to show you how we handle the multi-core part of locking, And this is similar to what XV6 does. The instructions XV6 uses are a little different because this is 64-bit x86 and not 32. So my acquire operation, I store one in EAX, and I do this atomic swap to make the lock contain one, to write one into the lock and read the old value into EAX, and then I see if it was zero before. So remember, this is set the lock to what was in EAX and read what was in the lock from EAX. So this global, the lock variable, if it previously contained one, then I acquired the lock. And if not, I didn't. And if I didn't acquire the lock, what I do is I just go back to the beginning. So this is called a spin lock. And the reason it's called a spin lock is that we run this loop over and over again until that atomic exchange instruction changes the lock from having a 0 to a 1. If it just makes the lock have a 1 when it already had a 1, we go again. And try again. Try to swap it with 1 and see if we swapped a 0 with a 1 and not a 1 with a 1. And our release operation is we have this fence to make sure the processor doesn't reorder loads and stores. I don't have one on this side because the lock instruction does that for us. And then I set the lock to 0. So later on, when someone exchanges 1 with it, they'll say, oh, I exchanged 1 with 0, not 1 with 1. And they'll think they got the lock. So this is a spin lock. So questions on how this works. So we have our set the lock to 1 and read the old value. And if the lock was already locked, try again. If not, we're done. Lock acquiring, and on release, just set it back to 0. Yes? Question, can I explain atomic exchange, how it relates to locking? So atomic exchange, so remember we said loads and stores like happen all at once or not at all? Like there's no in between? That's true of this whole operation. So all of this happens all together or not at all. There's no in between state that we can see. And the way that's guaranteed is that no one else is allowed to use memory at ECX while we're doing this, while the core that's executing this instruction is running. And this is enough for us to implement a lock and maybe some other synchronization constructs. Okay, other questions? Yes?
Why are we exchanging EAX
in the lock? We want to exchange the constant. We want to write one into the lock, so we put one in EAX. And we also want to read the lock, so we need a register to do that, so I used EAX. And this instruction both writes and reads the lock. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other end question there?
Yeah, so talking before, another thread to write 0 into the lock after the acquire, another thread used to acquire another.
Question, is it possible for another thread to write 0 into the lock after we've acquired the lock? So our convention for how locks work is that we only call release after we've successfully called acquire, which should prevent that from happening. So if someone releases the lock while we're calling acquire, either this move will happen before this exchange, in which case we'll exchange 0 and 1 and we'll acquire the lock, or it will happen after, in which case we'll try again and it will work the next time. And because it can't happen in the middle of the exchange, we're okay. Other questions? Yes? The reason we put the fence here is to prevent processor optimizations from deciding to, for example, run a store that's after this, a load that's after this return before the lock is released. Or, I guess more concerningly, to run a store that's before here after the lock is released. Does that answer your question? Okay. There's a question back there, but I guess not. Okay.
Right.
So the question is, why are we testing EX against itself? This is saying if EAX doesn't equal zero, go to acquire. Does that answer your question? Question doesn't test to subtract, test does a bitwise AND. Other questions? Okay, so I guess that's where I'm out of time, so I won't get to this exercise. And next time we'll talk about things besides spin lock, ways we can go beyond spin locks.